This is the October 13 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Frayne Olson. He's an agricultural economist from North Dakota State University Extension. And Ben Brown joins us from University of Missouri Extension, also an agricultural economist, and with FAPRI, the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute there. Thank you so much for being with us. Commodity Week, by the way, is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You may find it and listen to it anytime you'd like at willag.org. WILLAG.org. And there in the coming week, or at the Farm Doc Daily website, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu, you will find a way to register for the Farm Assets Conference. Now, the Farm Doc team is kicking off its winter meeting season with the Farm Assets Conference in January. We'll be on the road in DeKalb, Peoria, and Mount Vernon, plus another six webinars, and we'll wrap up with the all-day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. But this Farm Assets Conference is picking up from where we left off, actually in 2018. It'll be in its fifth year, and this year will be a really good one. We decided to pair the agricultural economist with some outside forces. So we'll talk about carbon markets in the morning. We'll also discuss Brazil. We'll take up land values in the afternoon. That'll be done by Bruce Sherrick along with Luke Worrell, who is with Worrell Land Services. We'll take up agricultural policy. Mary Kay Thatcher will be here. You might recognize her from the American Farm Bureau Federation. She is now with Syngenta, but covers agricultural policy for them. Jonathan Kappas will be there. Nick Paulson from the University of Illinois will also talk about the marketplace. Prices with Scott Irwin, Joe Jansen, ag economist, part of the Farm Doc team. Matt Bennett and Ben Coons will be there. Wayne Nelson and Brian Stark, folks that you hear regularly on our air. They're from agmarket.net, McDonald Pells, and the Andersons. And we'll take up field crop issues too with Aaron Hager, Nick Sider, Giovanni Frezza-Fontez, and Emily Heaton, all with Crop Sciences at the Farm Assets Conference the 21st day of November. Registration begins next week. Now let's begin our conversation. Frayne Olson, I want you to take me through yesterday's world agricultural supply and demand estimate just a bit. What did the numbers look like? I think I'll have you do corn and then come back to Ben and have him run through the soybean side and try to put it all together for the marketplace. So what happened with corn as it refers to both crop production and the world agricultural supply and demand estimates? And thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I always enjoy visiting. So I guess a couple of things that the markets were looking for. Obviously, we did get the quarterly stocks reports at the end of September. Those quarterly stock values become not only the ending stock values for last year's marketing year, but obviously we carry those forward into the balance sheets of the new marketing year. And the corn numbers came in a little bit lower than I think people had expected. Those were obviously transferred into the balance sheet that we have for the October estimates. The other thing we got was a slight as an update on the yield numbers, the yield forecast, not only by state, but also by the nation. We were expecting to see a slight slippage in the yield numbers. That was kind of what the trade was expecting to see. We got numbers very, very similar to that. So you add in you combine a little bit lower inventories from last year coming in, a little bit lower production this year, and we did tighten up the bottom line some. Now, I think part of the other portion to it, of course, is the consumption side. So we were expecting lower production, lower available supplies. The unknown was how was USDA going to adjust the expectation for the production or consumption numbers. And we did get some flipping around. We gained a little bit on the feed and residual numbers on the amount of corn going to the feed sector. We lost the exact same amount going into the ethanol industry, and the ethanol is slowing down a little bit because we didn't have as much driving this summer months during the summer driving season as expected. So that doesn't surprise me a bit. I guess I think the surprise for some people was a pretty stiff reduction in the exports number, about 125 million bushel reduction in exports. And there's some different theories on why that might have happened. or why USDA might have adjusted that. I do think some of it is the fact that there was a larger crop coming out of the Brazilian corn area. There's also some question, obviously, about how much corn will the Chinese be buying over the next 12 months or so, because they were relatively new to the U.S. corn market because of some trade issues, but the last several years they've become a major buyer of U.S. corn. So we still have a lot, long ways to go on the demand side, but that's real quick summary of what happened. When we get to the bottom line, numbers came out very similar to kind of what the trade was expecting, well within the range of what the trade was expecting, very close to kind of the average numbers. So not a lot of shock value in the soybeans, just kind of some confirmation of some things that we knew coming in.
And for the soybean then, Ben, what did the numbers look like?
Well, depending on where you look in the balance sheet on soybeans, I think you can tell a couple of different stories. The big thing there is that while the trade was expecting a little bit of an increase in national soybean average yield, we saw a 7/10 reduction per bushel, or in 7/10 bushel reduction in the national average crop. And that's kind of significant in a couple of ways, too. And 2 bushel decline from when this estimate was first released back in August. And I always contend that September is a big month for U.S. soybean production, just in the way our crop has grown. And this year, I think, was a very telling year, that when we were sitting in August thinking about what this crop could be and what it certainly looked like, it was, you know, it was late in some regards for the growth stage that we would expect it to see. But the potential was there for a very strong crop. And when the August estimate came out at 51.7 bushels to the acre, that tied our previous record. And certainly I do actually believe the potential was there, given, you know, what this crop looked like. However, it got very dry across many parts of the Corn Belt here in Missouri. Just in the last, you know, 2 days alone, as we sit here in October, we've matched our rainfall since the 10th of August. And so it turned very dry. That crop just didn't have the conditions to be able to continue to develop. And so I think that was kind of the factor that led to the reduction in yield. However, it was partially offset with the increase in ending stocks for the previous marketing year that we saw in the September 1 grain stocks report. That also was kind of a little bit of a surprise to the market. Many people had anticipated that those stocks would be, you know, at or even slightly below what we had seen prior. They came in a little bit higher, and so we had to work that into a higher beginning stocks number as we turn the calendar to the new marketing year. So when we take the reduction in production for 2022 into 2023, add in the higher beginning stocks that we saw from the old crop, or from last year into this year, you know, the next thing to consider would be, okay, now what happens on the demand side? And given those adjustments, especially that reduction in production, I'm not surprised to see USDA pull back on exports. We reduced exports 40 million bushels here in the month of October for the new crop. And, you know, that was also, you know, kind of dependent on what happened in the foreign market. USDA increased South America, especially Brazil soybean production, 3 million metric tons, based on some of the numbers we're seeing coming out of this early planting period down south, expanded acres, and right now at least favorable conditions to grow that crop. So maybe more competition from South America competing with us. The dollar is relatively strong to what we've seen it the last couple of years, making our products more expensive to international buyers. And certainly, I think, you know, there, at least right now, there's the expectation that Brazil could produce a crop. However, we're not out of a tight soybean market yet. I mean, there's strong potential either way for this crop and these markets to move. And I think we're kind of seeing that as some of these numbers, whether it was the stocks report last month or whether it was the production report this month, are kind of really creating some rather large changes with market prices.
Well, we will talk about those market prices. Speaking of which, the season's average cash price for each of the crops, and we'll pick up with wheat, which we've not talked about just yet, which raised 20 cents, is now $9.20 a bushel. They had an ending stocks drop in that WASDE, or World Agricultural Supply Demand Estimate, from this week for October to 576 million bushels. down 34 million bushels. The corn number raised 5 cents, $6.80 for the whole of the season. And while the numbers for soybeans were perceived by the trade as being relatively friendly to the soybean market, USDA dropped the season's average cash price by 35 cents a bushel, from $14.35 to $14 even. How important are the wheat numbers in this marketplace, Brain, as it relates to corn?
You know, there is this interaction, and first we got to realize that the wheat market is obviously very specialized. It's more of a food-based product than a feed-based product or an industrial use. And typically it works the other way around, where the corn market has, because of its size and importance, kind of kicks the wheat market around once in a while. But you know, one of the things we are looking at is of course the from a global perspective, you know, what's happening in particular in Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine being obviously a major exporter of both wheat and corn. We knew that the corn supplies coming out of the Black Sea region were going to be down significantly. I think a lot of that was already obviously baked into the marketplace. But when we look forward and start thinking about acreage for, you know, 2022-23, as we move into next year, we're worried about the winter wheat seedings going on right now. Now, the window for winter wheat seedings is relatively wide. There's a lot of flexibility in it. But we get into the transition areas. You get the soft red winter wheat area in southern Illinois. You get into the hard red winter wheat areas into Kansas and Oklahoma. We do have transition areas of those farmers that, well, if we don't plant some winter wheat, we'll probably wait for possibly some corn going into the next spring. You know, when in doubt, farmers will usually, the winter wheat guys will usually put the wheat in the ground and wait to see what happens next spring and then make a decision. Do we want to rip that up and put something else in, or do we let the winter wheat crop go? But I am starting to get some reports now that on the supply side, that there are some farmers in particular in Kansas, because of the very dry conditions, that they're just saying, you know, maybe this wheat thing isn't going to work. And so I would not be surprised to see some, when the reports come out in January, some minor cutbacks in some of the hard red winter wheat seedings. Obviously, we'll have to wait to see on that. But that does open the door then to some change in planted acres as we move into 2023. And so short term, I don't know that there's going to be a lot of influence from the wheat market back into the corn market. But as we get into talking about 2023 production, there might be something there.
Why do you suppose, I'll come back to soybeans, Ben, that USDA lowered their season's average cash price to $14 from $14.35, despite the fact that the ending stocks remain the same?
Well, some of this is kind of how USDA calculates their season average price, looking out into deferred contract months, and then the forecast associated with futures markets. It also includes, you know, this is a farm average price, so they're also assuming cash bids and making assumptions about cash bids at the local level. And we have seen cash bids really pull off in different places around the country as transportation costs have gone up. And Frayne certainly much more qualified to talk about this than I am, but you know, we would assume basis bids would be lowered at the farm gate as transportation goes up. And that's exactly what we've seen this year from a range of different modes of transport. And so I think that was, you know, that's a part of this in terms of where the product's grown and where we're seeing some of these cash bids this year. It's still very early. And so this is a very sensitive, you know, kind of variable within the equations. You know, little changes can cause, you know, that season average cash price to move quite a bit. And so, you know, with the deferred months plus the change in basis, it really starts to impact that average farm price. And I'll ask Frayne if he has anything else he wants to say about the transportation issue here as it relates to farm cash prices.
No, so Ben's right. I mean, what USDA is trying to forecast is the average price received by farmers over the entire marketing year. And obviously, we had some really high prices this last spring. Trying to get incentivizing people to keep planting, especially here in the Northern Plains. We had a pretty late spring, a lot of concern about, you know, whether we're actually going to get much of a crop seeded in the first place. So we came off of some really, really high prices this spring. They've been drifting lower as we move into the summer. We have a slight carry in the market, but that on the futures right now today, but that carry doesn't last very long. So I do think some of this downward movement in the average prices is really just an anticipation that as we move through the rest of the marketing year, that as farmers start to sell more of their cash grain and actually get paid for that, that we will have a window of opportunity here. But if that South American crop really gets to be as large as what some people are forecasting right now, I do think by the time we get into 2023 calendar year, that we're going to start to see soybean prices starting to soften a bit. And so I think some of this is an anticipation of what we're going to see later on. Basis levels are also obviously part of that as well. And as Ben is bringing up, we have some transportation logistics things, problems showing up now, in particular on the barge rates and the ability to be able to move some of this harvest grain into the export terminals, in particular in New Orleans. And we can talk about that in more detail if you wish. But, you know, as we start to get this backlog of grain movement by barge, there's a tendency then barge rates are going up very quickly. We also start to shift some alternative transportation systems like rail that tends to be a little bit higher. A lot of the grain that's being moved right now has already been sold. And so the scheduling system is that the vessels need to arrive. And as soon as the vessels arrive, they need to be loaded because the demurrage costs in an ocean-going vessel, nobody wants to pay that. That's a pretty very steep bill, and so there's tremendous pressure to make sure that the grain is at the export terminal when the vessel arrives to make sure that it gets loaded. So the pressure now is to say how do we have a workaround for this slower barge traffic, the lower volumes that are being moved from the lower Mississippi. Rail is a portion of that equation, and also possibly diverting to some other ports, whether that be the Galveston, Houston ports, or whether it be going out of the PNW and rerouting some of the shipping. All of those have a higher cost to them. And I want to remind everybody that when we talk about these transportation costs, that cost is always shared between both the buyer and the seller. And we're starting to see that on basis levels at the port facility starting to increase. We're starting to see the basis levels at local elevators starting to decrease to compensate for that. So I want to remind everybody, I know there's a common belief that the farmer pays all the bills when it comes to changing transportation costs, but it's always shared to some degree. Sometimes the farmer pays more and the buyer pays less, and sometimes it's vice versa. So right now, from what I am seeing, most of this backlog and the increased cost of transportation is really being paid by either the system itself, the elevators that are involved, or the buyer, the end buyer at the export terminal.
This is because the grain that's moving has already been sold and priced into the marketplace, correct?
This is because everything has already been booked. This is that the grain has been purchased, the grain has been sold. It's just a matter of making sure that the grain arrives at the right place, the right time to get loaded, and on its way to the international markets. And so there's typically, if you're an international buyer and you're trying to schedule purchases, you're often thinking anywhere from 3 to 6 months forward. So that the grain that you're buying and booking today is something that will be delivered to your port anywhere from 3 to 6 months from now. So a lot of the grain that's being shipped right now today was purchased several months ago. And so this is just a matter of getting the logistical system to work. And so if there's some disruptions and the costs are going up or you have to reroute product, it's typically someone within the shipping system that has to absorb that.
So with the understanding potentially that we may remain dry in the system for the drought and water levels on the Mississippi River, does that make a difference to end users domestically, especially in the Western Corn Belt ethanol plants there, the livestock industry, who might tend to be booking at shorter dates, so that they might be just-in-time bookers? They don't have the grain there, but I would think their bids would have to be tremendous, kind of like they are at the moment. But in the future, that basis might start to give way a bit because there'd be available grain that's not being moved out the river system, whether it's the PNW or Galveston or ports, I suppose, or New Orleans? I'm trying to get an understanding of what happens over time and how it backs up into the domestic marketplace.
Sure. And that's a really good question. And you're absolutely right. Your thought process is correct that right now, I guess the National Weather Service is currently forecasting that the river levels will drop for at least another 2 weeks. So we haven't quite reached the bottom yet. And at least, again, that's about as far forward as they're willing to forecast river levels. But the anticipation now is that the water levels will drop for at least another 2 weeks. How fast that will go down or how fast it will recover is still open for debate. So the point is that even if river levels do come up, it's still going to take a while for those levels to get to a point where we can get back to the full flow. So anticipation right now is that these lower river levels, the slower barge traffic is going to extend and last for a while. You know, again, nobody knows exactly how long, but it's going to be there for a while. And the record low of at least for lower Mississippi was actually set in October of 1988. And we're getting very close to those levels right now. So how does that adjust the system? Well, obviously, especially for corn, but also for soybeans, the Gulf ports in particular, New Orleans is one of our high throughput facilities. That's that a lot of grain gets shipped through that. Well, if the volume is slower, barge rates start to increase, rail rates start to increase, you know, that cost differential has to be absorbed and paid by someone longer term. And yes, I do think we will continue to see local basis levels, especially along those river channels, to start to drop as we go into harvest now. Part of it's just the simple harvest pressure selling, prep off the combine, but a lot of it is just can't move the product as quickly as possible. So that does open up opportunities then if you are a domestic buyer. If you're somebody within that local area, because basis is really local prices. So we can see basis levels in one part of the U.S., one part of a state very different from the basis levels in another part of the state. And obviously the ones that are being most impacted right now is right along the river. I do suspect those lower basis levels will start to move into more of the interior part of states as we move forward. But it does open up some buying opportunities, as you suggested, for domestic processes, for other domestic users like a feed mill, whether it be an ethanol plant, whether it be a soybean crushing plant, you know, that does open up some opportunities. Now, the one follow-on comment, I just want to point this out for clarity, is that if you're an ethanol plant or an oilseed crushing plant, you know, you're not always in the spot market. They're always buying something off the spot market, but a lot of times they are forward contracting. Now, their planning horizon isn't as long as an international buyer, but they're often bidding for product, you know, even 6 or 12 months into the future. Now, they don't have a lot of coverage. They don't have a lot of their total needs booked at that point. They're always open some. They're always being, you know, buying some off the spot market every day. But they have a lot of those product also booked because they don't want to run short. They don't want to be too reliant on the spot market at any one time. So, yes, there's some opportunities for those buyers that do need the extra product or have the capacity to be able to bring in the extra product, and whether they use it immediately or whether they store it. So if you're a corn buyer or soybean buyer over the next several months and you have really good local supplies, I think you're going to have some pretty good deals coming up.
Ben, I'll rely on your expertise a bit here to follow up. What should a producer take away from the conversation we've been having as it relates to basis, the availability of labor for transportation in the rail industry, what's happening on the Mississippi River and how that backs up into the local areas, and when and how they ought to price both corn and soybeans? Is there something there that gives a producer a tangible way to think about this as it's related to his own grain or oil seeds?
Yeah, and I'll first just start off by saying I was at an ethanol plant earlier this week, had a group in town that was interested in buying U.S. ethanol, and so we were trying to facilitate some stuff and visit an ethanol plant, and they told us the exact same thing Frank just told you, and the rest of the audience was, they're never overly dependent on a spot market. And part of the reason for that, and I think this is pretty straightforward, is there's large costs to being shut down. And you never want to run out of grain, similar to a livestock feeder. You don't want to run out of corn because you got to have that to keep the animals alive moving forward. So there is some planning. And so it does kind of, I'm going to say, it takes some of the flexibility out of, some of these end users, local end users, to kind of capitalize on conditions of potentially lower cash prices or cash bids. And so it takes some of that flexibility out for them. But regardless of all that, in total, what Frayne said is kind of what's happening. As far as how a producer can kind of take a look at some of this is, basis is a tricky thing for people to kind of comprehend and understand. And I think there even is a little bit of a misunderstanding about what basis is and is not across many at the farm gate. And then the second part of this is how to use it in an action plan, or think about what a basis market is telling you. And the reason I say it's a little bit tricky is because most farmers can tell you what the cash price that's being offered at their local elevator or a couple of markets might be. And in some cases, they can even tell you what the futures price is, or, they're aware of what the futures price is at the moment. But you never rarely hear people talk about basis. However, basis is in a lot of ways what tells us what contract to use, whether that's a futures contract, forward contract, a hedge to a rise. When we have strong basis in a relative sense, that's where a basis contract and locking in that high basis and taking advantage of that, makes sense. If we're at a relatively low basis during a part of the year, maybe you're looking at a futures contract only, looking to lock some of that basis in at a later time. So, it does provide kind of the signal in terms of which tool in the toolbox might serve a producer better as we move through the marketing season. But I think, my takeaway from what Frayne just said and all of that, and then kind of what I deal with at a local level all the time with producers is, what's actually driving, the basis in your market in terms of knowing, how and where and why basis fluctuates is really important, and kind of feeds into some of that understanding of when might we see a seasonal high, or, based on this set of outcomes, what does that potentially mean for my local cash price as it relates to the, futures market as well. So that's I guess, my underlying thing is be aware of what's driving your market. And also it helps to be, kind of aware of what basis is doing. There's times where basis isn't really changing when it probably could, because the futures market's doing the work of the basis. In some cases, and the elevators are allowing price increases or decreases to pull or slow that grain in, and they're not having to provide that signal to their producers. Those happen, and certainly that's a case. But when we see strengthening and weakening of basis, that's a signal that something's happening that is dictating our local cash market. So I don't know if I really answered your question there. Basis is something I think is really important. The folks up in North and South Dakota have been dealing with basis issues for a long time. Here down here in the southern part of the Corn Belt, I'd say we're relatively novice when it comes to basis understanding. And maybe that's unfair to those people that know basis really well, but we're seeing it this year a lot. The Western Corn Belt is really working to move product to grain deficit areas. And we're certainly seeing the river market just over the last couple of weeks really drop those basis bids, in some cases, down over a dollar over the last month just on the basis component of that.
So I think I'll end with this for both of you, and it may very well vary by region some, but farmers who must take grain across a scale, soybeans or corn, should they store it at the elevator commercially or not, or should they make the sale across the scale?
Well, so I just talked about basis kind of giving us an indication of the tool to use in the toolbox. When it comes to storage decisions, we talk about market carry within the market, what the deferred contracts on the futures market are maybe signaling. And so I walk through exercises with farmers where we think about the possibility of storage, right? So to some extent, an interest rate expense is included because that represents our opportunity cost. We're thinking about, some type of a shrink or, spoilage. Again, that probably matters more whether you're storing on farm or you're selling at the elevator as to who owns that risk. You know, we're talking about basis appreciation. Do we think basis is you know, going to appreciate? And if it is, you know, maybe not locking in a basis contract at storage. But then, you know, the carry in the market, right? So if the market's inverted, that tells us that there's no incentive to store per se. And if there's carry in the market, you know, maybe waiting and paying that storage cost as we look at ahead. So we can compare those between the two markets. The question I get most isn't necessarily on farm or commercial elevator. It's more of, you know, what am I going to fill up if I have storage on farm, right? And so this maybe isn't, you know, that year because a lot of people are selling across the scales at the elevator this fall. And you know, might not use all their storage on farm, but if they don't have, you know, if they have to pick between the two crops, the question I get asked a lot is, okay, which crop should I store? And we can go through a very similar exercise and compare the two to determine that. So,
did that change yesterday?
In terms of the decision to store or not, I haven't.
Which crop?
Well, yeah. So which crop? So I don't think so. I would need to go through and just kind of look at that all again. And I'm, you know, I haven't done that since yesterday, but I don't think it did. I think we're kind of still sitting in the same scenario. Frayn can correct me if I'm wrong.
I would agree with Ben. I guess the one little tweak or refinement that I would suggest is, I mean, when you look right now at kind of carry in soybean market versus carry in the corn market on the futures, we do have a stronger carry in the soybean market. My caution to those people that are looking or thinking about storing soybeans is that be very careful that you don't miss the window of opportunity. That a lot of what we see right now is this driving kind of the carry is the anticipation that China is going to come in and be a really strong buyer from the U.S. because we are the ones that are supplying soybeans right now. But by the time we get into that January, February timeframe, by the time that the South Americans start to harvest their crop, that shift happens relatively quickly. It's not only China, but it's a lot of the other soybean buyers in the globe start switching to the South American supplies. So we really have a window of opportunity in soybeans over the next several months where the U.S. soybean market is kind of the dominant place. It's the place to come if you need beans. So right now there is an incentive from kind of the simple math right now to store soybeans, at least for a short time period. But I wouldn't be too aggressive in saying that you're going to store for a long time. So I think you've got a few months here where you might have some opportunities, and I think there's going to be a lot of volatility in the soybean market given the very tight supplies. Corn is a little bit different. The corn gets to be more challenging. It really does become much more of a local market. We don't have a lot of carry in the futures market right now, so the futures market's not giving you a really strong incentive to store corn. But again, your local market can help dictate that. As Ben was explaining before, you know, basis is also a really important concept. Basis, in the way I explain it, is typically your local market trying to regulate the flow of grain over time and space. So as he suggested, if the basis is relatively narrow, if it's smaller than normal, usually negative, right? At least up here it is. That's signaling that, yes, we want grain to flow. The local market is saying, you know, bring it on. We need more grain coming into the system because it's leaving the system very quickly. But if that basis widens out, if it becomes more negative, the local market is saying, wait, slow it up. We the inflow of grain is faster than the outflow of grain. And so this is also a timing thing. So when you can look at the basis bids at your local elevator or at the feed mill and saying, okay, what's the basis for delivery today versus delivery, let's say, in a December timeframe. So we do need to kind of play those games, but your local market as well as the futures is trying to regulate that or trying to signal to you. So the futures market is signaling, well, we're not going to give you a big premium for storing, you know, so maybe you want to sell some off the combine, but your local elevator or your local ethanol plant or your local feed mill might be saying, no, we've got enough supply right now. Our basis levels are more negative than normal. You know, we'll pay you or provide an incentive for you to put it in the bin and deliver it sometime later. So corn gets to be a little more challenging just because it is going to be more influenced in today's market anyway by what's happening with your local supply and demand conditions. So soybeans, I think there's an incentive to store right now, but don't store too long. For corn, there's not a real strong signal in the futures market, but your local market might be talking to you.
Matted Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. Just click and play right from the website, or you can listen to it as a podcast. It's easy enough just to search out Commodity Week in your favorite podcast application, or you can hit the podcast tab at willag.org and subscribe inside the player there. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Frayne Olson, agricultural economist at North Dakota State University Extension, and Ben Brown, agricultural economist, University of Missouri Extension, and with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.